We all have heroes, but we don't usually get to meet them, let alone work with them. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and we've got a story today, a conversation about working with a dream team, the heroes of 20th century physics. Our story begins in the 1930s in Great Britain. This was a time when if you were a kid with a big dream and a big brain, you did not go into science.
The time when I grew up, which was in the 30s, science was very unpopular. Science was responsible for the horrors of World War I, and especially the chemists, of course, with chemical warfare. That was so horrible. So science, when I was in high school, only the dumb kids would take science. It was so taken for granted. If you were really capable, you'd do Latin and Greek. If you were second rate, you'd do French and German. And if you're third rate, you'd do science.
Meet Freeman Dyson. He grew up to be a legendary scientist. He was a friend and colleague of the giants, the people who split the atom, built the nuclear bomb, and refined quantum theory. Today, he's almost 93 years old. He's no longer an active scientist, but he is still affiliated with the place that has been his intellectual home for six decades, Princeton's famed Institute for Advanced Study. Steve Paulson talked with him for Nautilus magazine, and here's their full conversation.
I want to start out by taking you back to your very first dreams of becoming a scientist when you were a child. When did you first fall in love with numbers?
Oh, when I was about three, I believe. I mean, before I could read, I was certainly calculating, and it was just a toy I loved to play with, and I don't know where it came from.
So from the whole time when you were growing up and to the time that you were going to college, you kind of knew that you would become a scientist or at least a mathematician?
Yes, it was more mathematics than science, but I read a lot of science, and of course there were lots of good popular science books. I read Eddington and, of course, Wells, who were very good writers, and they made science enticing.
So you also read science fiction, and that was part of the appeal?
Yes. I mean, what I remember most vividly was Jules Verne. I read Hector Servadac, who was one of the books of Verne, about an expedition to a planet. I must have been about 8 years old when I read that, and I thought it was all true, and came as a big disappointment. Later on, I discovered it was just a story.
Have you continued to read science fiction over the course of your life?
Yes, but rather less recently, since I'm just slowing down altogether, I suppose, and so I tend to sit around just meditating rather than reading. But I still enjoy a good story.
So you said that when you were growing up, it was mathematics even more than science that you were interested in. Why did you choose not to stay in pure mathematics once you got to college? Why did you go into physics?
Well, it was partly, I think, because of the bomb that just about that time I made the switch. I was in England all through the war, and because we knew nothing about nuclear bombs. And then suddenly Hiroshima, and then the war was over. So we were just hugely grateful to these physicists who had somehow brought the war to an end. And then I thought, well, it would be interesting to get to know those people and find out what they've been doing. In addition, of course, there was quantum mechanics. And I had the feeling everything I did in mathematics was of interest only to five or six people in the whole world. Whereas if I worked in physics, I'd be doing something with much more public consequence, and in the end would be more important. And so that was a reason for switching.
So when you were first coming up, when you were young and coming up as a scientist, were there scientists that you really looked up to? I mean, did you have heroes?
Oh, yes. And certainly one of them was Haldane, the biologist, who wrote excellent popular books. And there was, of course, the people in Cambridge whom I got to know personally, Hardy and Littlewood and Bezukhovich, who were all three of them great mathematicians. And, I mean, the joke was that they spent most of their time playing billiards. Bezukhovich had a wonderful billiard table, so that was where most of the mathematics was done, around the billiard table.
Well, if they're going to have some sport, it seems like billiards would be the right sport for mathematicians.
Well, for elderly mathematicians. Of course, Hardy had been a passionate cricketer when he was young, but when I knew him, he was old, and he switched from cricket to billiards. Anyway, I was very lucky because my father had bought a billiard table when I was a child. So we had grown up playing billiards at home. So I immediately fitted into this coterie in Cambridge. So if I wanted to talk to the big mathematicians, I would just start playing billiards, and then the conversation would turn to mathematics.
How math and science really works. You have to be able to play the right games.
It's a question of getting to know the right people, of course.
So then after the war, you went to Cornell as a graduate student in the late 40s, and you ended up working with one of the towering figures in physics.
Hans Bethe, yes.
Did he become a mentor to you?
Yes, very much so. An extraordinarily good one. I mean, he was amazing with students. And he always found the right problem for each student, just difficult enough, not too difficult. So he was an ideal person to have as a mentor.
What was the right problem for you?
Well, it was concerned with quantum electrodynamics, which was just bursting open at that time. There was a group of experimenters at Columbia in New York who had been looking at the hydrogen atom with the tools that they had developed during the war. Microwaves were invented during the war for military purposes, for radar. And it turns out microwaves were just what you needed to study quantum mechanics with great accuracy. So Willis Lamb at Columbia was tickling the hydrogen atom and measuring very precisely the energy levels of hydrogen. And it turned out the standard quantum theory gave the wrong answers. So something quite new was needed, and Bethe worked it out. You know, Bethe had this extraordinary ability to do very simple calculations, which were quite sloppy, but gave roughly the right answer. And then he gave me the problem of doing the same calculation, but much more accurately. So that's what I did.
And then you met Richard Feynman, and you ended up working with him on quantum electrodynamics.
Well, I never worked with Feynman, but I learned a tremendous lot from him because he was a young professor. I was just a student. So I listened to Feynman, and of course, he was a genius, and he was also a clown, and he loved to perform, and so he always needed an audience. So I was very happy to be the audience.
Of course, there have been so many stories that have come up around Feynman over the years. You already said he was a genius, but what made him different from other scientists?
Well, he was extremely original. He had his own way of doing science, which was different from everybody else. That's why he had a hard time to communicate. He never wrote down equations. Most people, I mean, this is in physics especially, you do physics is you write down an equation and then you find out what are the solutions. But that wasn't the way Feynman did it. Feynman just would write down the solutions without ever writing down the equations. So it seemed like a sort of magic. The fact that he thought in terms of pictures instead of equations. So he had these little pictures in his head and he scribbled little pictures on paper. Nobody understood what they meant. So that was my job, to translate Feynman into language other people could understand.
Now, you never got your PhD, did you?
No. I was so lucky I slipped through the cracks.
You were lucky? You didn't want a PhD?
No, I hate the PhD. I think it destroys people's lives. I had actually three tragedies which I witnessed with people who came to work with me and came to grief. One of them committed suicide. Two of them ended up in mental institutions. And I blame the PhD system for that. I mean, I think it really was a disaster for many people.
Why do you blame the PhD system? Just because it grinds people down? It takes so long?
Yes. And it's completely inappropriate for what most people need. I mean, it was designed for German academics in the 19th century. And for that, it was fine. I mean, if you want to spend your life being a German academic, then that's the right kind of preparation. But for any other kind of life, it's totally wrong. It takes far too long. It forces you to sort of pretend to be a researcher when most people don't want to be researchers. It's become a union card. And I think it's highly destructive, particularly bad for women, because for women to waste 5 or 10 years of their lives is more of a disaster than it is for men.
Why? Because they might have family responsibilities as well?
Yes, because this biological clock is ticking much more for them.
And that was never a problem for you, not having the PhD, not having that credential?
No, fortunately. In those days, it wasn't as rigid as it has become later.
When you did get to Princeton, there were, of course, many famous scientists there, including Albert Einstein. Did you ever get to know him?
No, and he didn't encourage the young people to get to know him. He never came to our seminars. He never came to lunch. All we saw him walk by every day. Of course, he was tremendously busy with affairs of the world. He was very much in demand. People came every day, important people came to visit. And so he just didn't have time for saying hello to the kids.
But it sounds like he didn't want to say hello either. I mean, that was not part of his makeup to deal with the up-and-coming generation.
That was true. And he didn't enjoy teaching. So for him, I mean, there were two important things. There was his own work, which he always continued. And there was his public activity as a politician, which he did extremely well. I mean, he really was a serious player in the international game and took it seriously and actually had a good effect.
You're talking about in terms of matters of war and peace and that kind of thing.
Yes, and civil liberties especially.
So back then, back when you were at Princeton, first there, what did you think of Einstein?
Well, I mean, I admired him tremendously, of course, both as a scientist and as a public figure. And we all knew he was a great man, but we also considered him sort of out of it. He wasn't interested in the things that were going on in science. So as far as we were concerned, we didn't have anything to learn from him, and he probably felt the same way about us.
And do you think that was accurate? Had his time come and gone in science?
Yes. I mean, certainly that was true. He missed the bus as far as the physics that was going on after the war.
Now, didn't you also get to know Niels Bohr, who often came to visit?
Yes, and he was totally different. I mean, Bohr was, of course, about the same age as Einstein, but much more in touch. And so he talked to everybody. He was interested in everything, and he was well-informed, and he gave us good advice. And so, I mean, he was definitely part of the community. He came to seminars. He also came to lunch. We had a lot of interaction with him.
I mean, it's so fascinating to hear you talk about these people. I mean, you're kind of describing in a way, I guess, what it means to be a successful scientist, especially as you age. And partly what you're suggesting is you need to make sure that you keep in touch with the younger people, the up-and-coming people, even if they haven't made names for themselves yet.
Yes, that's very important. And I think, on the whole, the biologists are better at that than physicists.
There were other people who came through Princeton. I don't know if they were there when you were there. Wolfgang Pauli. Did you know him?
Well, I knew him very well, but of course I'd been with him in Switzerland. He was the chief professor in Zurich. I was living in Zurich for half a year, and so I saw him every day. We became good friends. He liked to go for a walk after lunch. He would invite me to go along, so I had many conversations with him. Of course, he was full of stories, and he was a great joker, too.
Did you mainly talk about science on those walks or other things, life in general?
Oh, everything. And he was particularly interested in psychology. He was a personal friend of Jung. He had been analyzed by Jung, and so he talked a lot about that.
Well, and there are fascinating stories about his friendship with Carl Jung. I mean, Jung believed in various psychic phenomena, and so did Wolfgang Pauli.
Oh, yes. He had all sorts of weird ideas, but he was at the same, he had a great sense of humor. He never took himself too seriously.
Now, we've been talking about various eminent scientists that you knew. Another was Robert Oppenheimer, who came to Princeton shortly after leading the Manhattan Project. And what I've always heard about him is he was a truly gifted leader, at least while he was running the Manhattan Project, probably a better administrator than a scientist. True?
Well, I don't know whether that is true. I mean, he did one really important thing in science, which was the theory of black holes. I mean, really, he discovered black holes, which turned out to be extremely important. But that was done in 1939 with his student. So they developed this theory of why black holes exist, and he got everything right. I mean, essentially, he was the originator of black holes as a concept, and it was a prediction which turned out to be true. But the sad thing was that was published on the 1st of September 1939, actually the day that Hitler walked into Poland. So the whole world was looking at Poland and not Oppenheimer. So that piece of work somehow got forgotten, and Oppenheimer himself lost interest in it, and he never went back to it later. So it sort of went out of his life, and it was a shame. He could have done a lot more with it. It all had to be sort of redone 20 years later. So he was a big scientist, but the strange thing is that the really great thing that he did was not what he wanted to do. He wanted to do particle physics, and he wasn't interested in astronomy. Hmm. Anyway, that's the way the ball bounces. You never know what you end up being famous for.
So you must have gotten to know Oppenheimer once he took over the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. What were your impressions of him?
Well, he was my boss. I had a sort of very mixed feelings. He was a very temperamental, unpredictable kind of character. He would suddenly blow hot and blow cold, and you never knew which one you had to deal with. He could be extremely generous and friendly, or he could be very harsh. I had family problems when I came to the Institute, and he was very helpful and generous on a personal level. He was a very good friend. But on the other hand, he could be unreasonably brutal on scientific questions. He was very quick to go to judgment, and if he decided somebody was no good, then that was final. And so there were some bad cases of that.
My guest is Freeman Dyson, the renowned physicist who is now in his mid-90s, still writing articles and books and telling us what he thinks about science and the world at large. So it's fascinating to hear you tell these stories. I mean, because you're talking about the giants of modern physics. I mean, some of the people who founded the physics that we know today, this seems like it was a golden age of science. I mean, what I would call a heroic age, when major discoveries about the nature of reality were revealed. Do you look back at it that way?
Yes. I mean, of course, the real golden age was the 20s when quantum mechanics was developed. I mean, quantum mechanics was a much bigger revolution in the 20s than what happened in the 50s when I was involved. So ours was sort of a silver age as compared with the golden age. But still, it was a good time to do physics. And it was a time when bright kids were, most of us went into physics. And so it was a very an exciting time for the young people. And it was a time of opportunity. I mean, you didn't worry about getting a job. There were plenty of jobs. The field was expanding fast. Any sort of second-rate physicist could do first-rate work. And that's the best time to be active, of course. And a third-rate physicist could do second-rate work.
Well, I mean, this was also a time when certain scientists were true heroes. I mean, Einstein above all, but you also had people like Feynman. And I guess I wonder if we still have those kinds of heroes in science today.
Well, I would say they mostly are going into biology now. Biology is moving very fast. So the same kind of people who would have become physicists in those days, nowadays they're tend to become biologists. And now, of course, theoretical biology is becoming much more of a real subject now than it used to be. So a lot of people who are really computer scientists are actually doing biology. So the line between mathematics and biology is not so sharp anymore. I would say that's where the young people are. They're having the same good times now that we had 50 years ago.
So why is biology a more exciting area to work in than physics is now? Because, I mean, a lot of people would say there's all kinds of interesting stuff happening in physics, but you're saying the action is really in biology.
Well, it's a question of speed. I mean, physics has slowed down tremendously. And in the 1940s, when I came into physics, a really important experiment would take 3 months to do. I mean, it would sit on a table. It would take 2 months doing the construction, putting the apparatus together, 1 month doing the experiment, and it's done. Well, now it takes 10 years. So a typical physics experiment today involves a whole army of people. It takes millions and millions of dollars, or maybe billions, and it takes 10 years. So the whole thing has slowed down tremendously. In biology, it's still pretty rapid by comparison. I mean, biology will have the same problems, of course. It tends to become slower as time goes on because the experiments get more elaborate. But at the moment, biology today is about where physics was in the 1950s.
Well, and it sounds like you're also talking about how much of physics is part of what I would call big science. I mean, most obviously, the Large Hadron Collider, you know, that does take billions of dollars to build and involves literally thousands of people, thousands of scientists to work on that.
Yes, that's the extreme case. But a lot of physics is like that. And in fact, the part of physics that goes rapidly is what I would call astronomy. I mean, it is, you can, with a telescope, you can discover things quite fast. You can switch from one part of the sky to another. The telescope may take 10 years to build, but once you have it, it doesn't take so long to do observations.
What about the fact that we still don't have a unified theory in physics? I mean, there is the classical world of stars and planets, and then the quantum world of the very tiny of atoms and electrons, and no one's been able to figure out how to bring those two realities together in some theoretical model. Is that a problem?
Well, for some people it is. For me, it's something to rejoice in. I like it better to have two universes rather than one. And I mean, I think the classical world is real and the quantum world is real too. And I mean, the beautiful thing is how well they fit together, even though they're so totally different. So I like the difference. So I hope they won't unify them, but of course, nature will decide in the end.
Now, we've been talking about a lot of the great scientists who you've known personally, and I'm wondering if you can generalize at all about the personal or the intellectual attributes that make a great scientist, other than just, you know, out-and-out genius.
Yes, it's never easy to define, and they're all different. I would say they have a tendency to become a bit crazy when they get old. They sort of lose a sense of proportion. That made Bohr rather unusual, that he kept his sense of proportion right up to the end.
Is it the willingness to risk your reputation, to take on, you know, projects that other people think won't work, to sort of pursue crazy ideas? What is it that, if you can generalize it all, that leads to great breakthroughs?
Yes. I mean, first of all, it helps to be ignorant. I always say the time when I did my best work was when I was most ignorant. And I think that's true fairly generally. Knowing too much is a great handicap.
You're serious about that. I mean, that's not just sort of a clever thing to say.
No, it's true. I mean, especially if you've been teaching for some years, then things get so fixed in your mind, it's impossible to think outside the box. And I was in the lucky position of jumping into physics without ever having taken any courses in physics. I'd only been a pure mathematician up till that point. So I was completely ignorant of...
I would think that would be a problem. You would really need to have that background to work as a physicist.
Well, a little bit, of course, does help, but not too much.
What about the whole business of being subversive? Is that part of the makeup of a great scientist?
Yes, undoubtedly. You've got to destroy what exists in order to build something new. You have to take down what's old. And so that's a big part of it. It needs a lot of good taste, of course. I mean, if you destroy indiscriminately, it doesn't help at all. That's where the intuition comes in, understanding what parts of the old building should be taken down.
Yeah. Well, speaking of being subversive, I have to ask you at least briefly about climate change. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about global warming, but that is certainly where you have generated the most controversy in recent years. I mean, your skepticism about the scientific models about human-caused climate change, for which practically the entire scientific establishment has come down on you. And I guess I'm wondering, is this part of your subversive nature to raise questions about an issue that virtually all other scientists say is settled, doesn't need to be questioned anymore?
Well, but what you're saying is not true. I mean, I have not taken a poll among my friends, but still, I mean, there are lots of my friends who agree with me on this question. It's not just a tiny minority who are skeptical. That is a distortion of the truth. The media really have distorted the picture very much by always claiming that the vast majority of scientists agree with the orthodox views. It's really not true. There's a very wide variety of opinions.
In my understanding of your position is that you're not necessarily saying that climate change isn't happening. You're just saying you don't really understand it and no one else does either.
Right. And I think a large fraction of scientists would agree with that.
Hmm. So we were talking earlier about the heroic age in physics, at least, and you said it was the 1920s. And maybe, you know, when you were at the height of your work in the 50s, that was the Silver Age. Are we still in a heroic age of science?
Well, in biology, we are, certainly. And I would say in astronomy also. Astronomy is really in a golden age, partly because of our ability to process data. Telescopes are not so different now from what they were 50 years ago. But the processing of the images is totally different. That's why astronomy has jumped ahead so fast. And in addition, of course, you have spacecraft taking pictures out in space where the seeing is vastly better than it is on the ground. So that astronomy is also at a golden age. It depends very much on the tools rather than on the ideas.
And what about if we move more towards the technological end of things and, you know, the computer age and what's happening in Silicon Valley? Does that excite you?
Oh, yes. And, of course, I mean, that's, of course, the reason why astronomy has jumped ahead. It's because of Silicon Valley. And I mean, the same technology that gave us the cell phone also gives us these wonderful telescopes.
Hmm. So do you see any parallels between, I don't know, what's happening in Silicon Valley now and what once happened in physics?
That's an interesting question. I mean, for big jumps in science, so you need both ideas and tools. Both have to jump ahead. Sometimes it's more of one and sometimes more of the other. So, I mean, quantum mechanics was essentially about ideas. It was the ideas that moved so fast. Whereas astronomy, it is more driven by tools. And I think in biology, it is more driven by tools at the moment.
So it's often been said that physics is a young person's game, that the great discoveries are typically made by people, let's say, under the age of 40, even under 30. Do you think that's true?
In theoretical physics, that is true, yes. I mean, but experimenters can keep going much longer. Experimenters sometimes stay very productive right into old age, but that's a very different game. But for theoretical physics, certainly it's true.
Why is that? Why do you need that young, supple mind to do theoretical physics?
Because you need to be ignorant in a way. I mean, after a while, you get to be so attached to things as they are.
Now, that's interesting you say that. I was thinking you were going to say it's just, I don't know, you have more brain power when you're young. But you're saying the problem is you get too set in your ways.
I would say so, yes. I mean, of course, I don't know how to measure brain power anyway, but I certainly, I'm slowing down and that's quite noticeable, but I can't measure how much brighter I used to be than I am now.
How did that work for you? I mean, was there a certain point in your own career when you stopped doing the kind of mathematical physics you had once done and you thought you should focus your efforts in different directions?
Yes. Roughly speaking, at the age of 45 is sort of the turning point with a middle age crisis when you suddenly become aware of the fact you're not as smart as your students. So at that point, I decided to spend the second half of my life mostly writing books rather than doing calculations, which I think was a wise choice.
Has that given you the same kind of pleasure, or probably a different pleasure, but the same degree of pleasure, writing books, reflecting on the nature of science, the history of science, as actually doing the science?
Yes, I would say it is just as enjoyable. And it, of course, opened a lot of doors which weren't opened before. Writing books for the general public, I have become friends with other writers, friends with readers who read my books and we get in touch. It's made my life in many ways more interesting. When I was doing only science, all my friends were scientists. It's a narrower world.
Well, one thing I'm curious about, how do you think the perception of scientists today compares to back when you were starting out as a scientist in the 30s and 40s and 50s?
Well, it goes around in circles, of course. I mean, the time when I grew up, which was in the 30s, science was very unpopular. Science was responsible for the horrors of World War I, and especially the chemists, of course, with chemical warfare. That was so horrible, and that was very much in people's minds. So science, when I was in high school, only the dumb kids would take science. It was so taken for granted. If you were really capable, you'd do Latin and Greek. If you were second rate, you'd do French and German. And if you're third rate, you'd do science. So that was a...
Times have changed, haven't they?
Well, in some ways they've changed. But I mean, I think the sort of low opinion of science just due to the technological abuses is still there. Because now it's nuclear weapons rather than chemical weapons. And the abuses of biology also. And I mean, public is very distrustful of genetics. I don't think it's changed all that much.
Well, and you were working at a time and knew many of the people who sort of got at the paradox of science, I think. I mean, you know, the people who worked on the bomb. Many people say that was the most exciting time of their lives to those people at Los Alamos who built the atomic bomb. And yet, of course, it was, you know, produced the most devastation we've ever seen.
Yes, no, that's all true. And I mean, those people, of course, were all my friends. So I was very much in contact with them and with the way they were thinking about it. So I've been trying all my life to deal with problems of war and peace. That's always, for me, very much what I do when I'm not doing science, worrying about problems of war and peace. And that's, of course, a perennial problem.
Do you think those problems are as urgent now as they were back in the 1950s, you know, at the beginning of the Cold War?
Well, it's always urgent. It was particularly bad in the 30s when I was a teenager. We had to deal with Hitler, which was worse than anything we have at the moment to deal with. So it goes up and down. But there's definitely a huge problem there that we have the world divided into nations, which in so many ways is the whole basis of our society, and having a variety of cultures, a variety of languages, I find very good. That's what makes human species so creative, is having all this variety. Then on the other hand, we are all murdering each other. It's a question how you can reconcile those two aspects.
Are you fundamentally an optimist about the human species?
Yes. And I mean, it comes from having grown up in the 1930s. In so many ways, things were black in the 1930s. far worse than they are today. I mean, the people don't remember, of course, but in England in the 1930s, everything was covered with soot. I mean, I would go to London in the day, for a day, and the collar in my shirt would be black because there was so much soot in the air. And the whole country was polluted. So England is much cleaner now than it was then. The United States is much cleaner than it was. I mean, Pittsburgh used to be pretty black too. So pollution has got much less. The economic problems were much worse in the 30s than they are today. And above all, of course, we had World War II to look forward to. We were all quite well aware of Hitler and the fact that we were going to have to fight him and that probably we wouldn't survive. That was what I grew up with. That was far worse than the kind of wars we have today.
That's Freeman Dyson talking with Steve Paulson. You can read an edited version of this interview in Nautilus magazine, where you can also take a look at the great illustrations that go along with it. I'm Anne Strainchamps. If you like what you heard, To the Best of Our Knowledge interviews scientists and philosophers all the time. Also hip-hop diplomats, writers, and musicians. Check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio based in Madison, Wisconsin, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.